And at this time, we'd like to call up our first speaker tonight, which will be Paul E. from D.C.
Yeah, I see that.
I'm an addict named Paul. The program says Maryland because I was confused when they asked me. I live in Maryland. I'm an addict from D.C. My home group's in D.C. My home group's always been in D.C. I've always attended meetings in D.C. I used in D.C. I got clean in D.C. Okay? I just happen to live in Maryland. Grateful to be clean today. And that's the most important thing that I need to say at the beginning of any time I share that I've been asked to share, to speak, because it puts things in perspective for me. It puts up front what it is that's most important in my life, the fact that I am clean today. I've been given a program that saved my life, continues to save my life as long as I'm willing to practice a few simple things. You know, I told you I got clean in D.C. I got some charges and I got, and I knew I was going to get locked up. And so eventually I had to make the decision, what am I going to do? And it was out of desperation that I sought help in Narcotics Anonymous. You know, and I found it here. I didn't find what I thought I was looking for. I thought I was looking for a way out. I thought I was looking for, you know, it was all a big misunderstanding, let's forget the whole thing kind of stuff. But that didn't happen. You know, but what I found was something way better. You know, I found Narcotics Anonymous. I found a new way to live my life. You know, and I did do some time in prison, and I went in with the clear expectation in my mind I was going to do all the time they gave me, and that it was okay because I had something better waiting for me on the other side, you know. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful that I had that understanding or expectation in my mind because that made time easier. It also made working a program easier. You know, it made it necessary to work a program, to live just for today and like try to focus on myself. That's probably the most important thing you can do if you're locked up is mind your business. You know, seriously. So, you know, and I'm really grateful for those sorts of things, the things that I was forced to do, that I felt like I was forced to do. I was forced to take this program real seriously, you know, and, you know, so I'm a very blessed addict. Something happened there. Y'all can? Huh? Can y'all hear me? I don't know what happened. I didn't do anything.
Hold up, he's coming.
Oh, okay.
Hello? Well, can you all hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'm a really blessed addict, and you know, I came in and 10 days after I got to where I was going in this prison, I found they had meetings. You know, they called NA over the little intercom or whatever like that, and I was not even expecting it, you know, and I was so happy. I had 44 days clean when I got locked up, you know, and I had less than 2 months clean when they called for this NA meeting, and I ran up in there, you know, and I came in there, and there was one guy that I knew from the street who was a part of the panel carrying the meetings, the H&I meeting, into this facility. I cannot tell you how grateful I was to see this addict. you know, there it is. And, you know, and I don't know why I've been so blessed in my recovery. Well, I mean, really, for me, I feel like my recovery has been one thing placed in my path that allows me to continue on and move forward, you know. And I was given this opportunity to, like, be a part of Narcotics Anonymous. And people looked at me like I knew something because they said, oh, you got 44 days clean. They put me up front. You know, so I'm really, really a blessed. I'm a blessed addict is what I feel like, you know. And then people saw me up front and they thought, he knows something. So they're coming to me, ask me about N.A. I didn't know, you know, nothing, really. I mean, how much did you guys know at 44 days clean, you know? And so people are coming to me and acting like I know something. They put me in the middle of Narcotics Anonymous. You know, and so I really feel like I had a blessed time, you know, and for me, I worked a program in prison. I went to those meetings, then they shipped me off to Missouri, and I went to, the first week I got to Missouri, they had a meeting starting. You know, I didn't do that. That has nothing to do with me. I didn't start any of that stuff. It's just, this is how my recovery has been, you know, where things have been placed, fortunate things have been placed in my life. I got a sponsor when I was out there. I had worked the first step when I went down to Lorton, which is outside of D.C., their prison facility. And when I was in Missouri, I had an experience where I felt like I had to work a fourth step because I felt this pain and I knew I'd been lying to myself about something that was going on. It was about a girlfriend that was back home that I'd called, and clearly she was no girlfriend, you know what I mean? And and I was forced to, like, confront that denial, you know what I mean? And where I'm going with this is that in that fourth step is the first place where I was forced to, like, for me, I was, you know, part of it is writing about resentments and writing about relationships and you know, the most contentious relationship in my life was my family relationship with my father. You know, I was brought up in a household where, you know, it was a little rough. I'm sure many people had a lot rougher than me, but it was a little rough. You know, we have a fairly large family and it had a very domineering father who would, you know, beat us and you know, with whatever and you know, a lot of verbal and mental abuse. And you know, and I always say my older brother got the worst of it, but it was certainly a rough place growing up. You know, and so when I went to write this fourth step, you know, it's very difficult to write about your own part if you carry in all these resentments. And I had a lot of resentments toward my father, you know, and I went to my sponsor and I said, what is it I'm supposed to do? And he told me what I was supposed to do. He said, you know, if you have difficulty writing about somebody, writing about your own part, you're supposed to pray for them to have what you want for yourself, you know, you know, and I don't remember how much resistance I had to this idea. I certainly wasn't something I was wanting to do, you know, but I did it because I felt like I had to, you know, and I wanted to get better. And I couldn't write, you know, I was blocked, you know, because I couldn't see my part. I really couldn't. And so I had to pray for my father to have what it was I wanted for myself, you know. And that was really probably the beginning of this process that allowed me to let some forgiveness in my heart for you know, everything that had gone on, and it was just the beginning, you know what I mean? And I call that the resentment prayer, you know what I mean? And it is, for me, the beginning of the process, and I'll still practice that if I have to with whoever it is that I have resentment against, because I don't want to live there anymore, you know what I mean? You know, so that was the beginning of that process with my father, with allowing some forgiveness to set in. And you know, I struggled, and I was able to write through and write that four step. And I had, when I had to do another four step, and it's not like it went away, you know, but it allowed me to, like, move forward and focus enough on myself where I could write about myself, you know. And in the second four step, the same difficulties, but I really got a lot more relief this time in that fifth step with the sponsor that I had then, that really allowed me to not see so much the things that I had going on with my father and the forgiveness that I needed to extend towards him, you know, which is certainly a necessary part of recovery for me, because, you know, it's poisonous. You know, hatred and resentments are poisons. You know, they poison your body. They can make you sick. They can make me sick. I know that. Make me crazy, absolutely. You know, I can run around insane with resentments and hate and rage and all that stuff. And I've been there many times. I've been there sometimes clean, and I certainly was there many, many, many days while using. You know, but what he helped me with in that fifth step was allowing me to see not just my own part, but allowing me to see my own humanity. You know, because I couldn't see that, because I was brought up that if you can't do it right, don't do it at all. You know, that was something I was taught, you know, and so perfection, either you just don't try, which was one way I would practice, or the other way, it had to be fucking perfect. You know what I mean? And, you know, you got to be the best at it. You got to go for it. You got to do it right. You know, you got to work longer. You got to work harder. You know, all that stuff. But allowing me to see my humanity, that this was not a defect, that thinking that I wasn't human, thinking that I could be perfect, that I could do it all, was a defect, because it didn't allow me to, you know, forgive myself, you know, for not being this perfect person that's unattainable. You know what I mean? And, you know, and that was, you know, a tremendous help for me. And that was not perspective that I was ever going to get myself. You know, I didn't get it right in that first four step. I didn't get it right in that second four step. You know, I got it from the help of another addict who could point out things to me that I couldn't see for myself. You know, you know, and it certainly, again, at least for myself, you know, and I'm sure for many addicts, that's not the end of the story. It doesn't mean that I became able to, like, give myself a break or anything like that. It's just, you know, it was just one point in time where I allowed myself to, with previous time in my life, to recognize that I'm human. And it also allowed me to see that I lost my train of thought 100%. Well, there you go. You know, but I still get caught up in the same train of thought. I still get caught up in thinking that obsessive thought and compulsive behavior, where this one thing, I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it, and it's going to get done right now. You know what I mean? And that's something that's continued with me, you know, in my time clean, you know, because I've been clean a little while, and I can still be very, very obsessive. I can sometimes recognize it for what it is. Sometimes other people point it out to me, and then I can actually see it much quicker now than I could, you know, 20-some years ago, that I probably need to, like, step back and recognize that this is crazy, because that's what it comes down to. You know, when one fixed idea becomes everything that I can see, I guarantee I'm at least a little bit crazy. You know, because it obscures everything else in my life, you know. For me, typically it's work, which means that then my home life suffers, you know, because I come home dog tired, and I can't be anything but a, you know, miserable person when I'm tired all the time, you know what I mean? But, you know, when I had about, I don't know how long it was, it might have been 3 or 4 or 5 years clean, I'm not really quite sure. You know, my family had changed somewhat. You know, after I got clean, I'd been clean a little while. I got a couple other brothers in recovery, and my family members, my parents, my mother and my father, had gone to some meetings, and apparently my dad went to one meeting, and then, like, that was it. You know, like Families Anonymous or Naranon or one of those sorts of things. My mother continued to go. Anyway, he approached me when I had, I'm just not sure how much time I had clean. You know, I might have had 4 years, 5 years. I'm not really sure. And he came to me, and he, you know, he was trying to make amends, is what I believe he was trying to do. He was trying to express, you know, his sorrow and how badly he felt about, you know, the life that we were given, well, directed towards me specifically, the life that I was given growing up in his household. And it's not that I didn't want to accept it, but I'm so fearful of breaking down. You know, and I know I would have, that I deferred and demurred and said, you know, it's okay, Dad, or whatever, something. I don't know what the hell I said, you know, but I didn't. I always felt dissatisfied that I couldn't, like, fully accept his offer of expressing his remorse, you know, and I've seen it in his actions. I'd already seen it in his action to that point in time. I mean, you know, when I was locked up, he was coming to visit me 4 days a week. It was a 2-hour bus ride, you know, from where he was. He didn't drive, you know what I mean, and up to the prison. And in fact, for me, it was a relief to be transferred to Missouri because I felt so bad. You know, he's spending all this time doing this and all like that. But, you know, he tried to express his remorse and asking for that forgiveness. And I really couldn't complete it. I really couldn't give it to him. You know what I mean? Just because I was so afraid of breaking down because I don't like to show that side. I don't like to cry and to break down and be vulnerable. You know what I mean? And I felt like that was coming, and I couldn't do that, you know? And, you know, I think about that sometimes, you know, and I do, you know, because he's getting old now. You know, he's 82 and occasionally is in bad health, you know, and so that dogs me, and it's something I got to address, you know. That's the way I feel, because he made a remark to me. It was this past year, about 6 months ago, and it wasn't about me. He was expressing that my brother Ron had never asked him for saying that he never expressed his sorrow. My brother Ron is clean. He's been clean longer than me. He got some jail time. He killed two people, one of which was my sister when he was driving. You know, he was all fucked up, and my dad expressed that, you know, that Ron had never said he was sorry to him. You know, and that sort of, I haven't said this to my brother, you know, and I only see him, you know, he lives out of state, and I don't see him very often. You know, we spend a week at the beach every year together, and I haven't said that, you know, about my father's comment about that, you know. And I know when that whole thing went down, you know, I know as a family we really came together and expressed that, you know, we weren't going to be, you know, on my brother about this, you know, that, you know, we already lost one family member. You know, and that was when I was using, you know what I mean? And, you know, so it was a very rough time for the entire family, you know, but my father saying that thing to me really makes me think that I really got to, like, you know, tell him I understood what he's trying to do. You know, I know I have to do that, you know, and because, you know, I'm not going to necessarily have an opportunity if I don't take the time to make that happen, you know. You know, because those are probably the most critical events in my life is, you know, me getting locked up and getting clean and my brother, you know, driving his car with and his best friend, with my sister and his best friend, both killed. And, you know, those are probably the two things that are the biggest driving forces in my life, because it was after that I really just took a dive bomb. I just really didn't care. You know what I mean? And my addiction really just went full speed ahead. I just, you know, I really didn't care. You know, I know there are some people who can feel that. You know, I'm sure others have felt that way. You know, and when I made my A-step lift, it's certainly most of those people on there, with a few exceptions, came from what I wrote about in the fourth step. You know, it was pretty cut and dry. It was pretty clear. It was those who are closest and nearest, dearest to me, almost 100%. You know, there are a few people who I will never be able to make amends to because I don't know who they are. You know, people I've, you know, I may have killed. I really don't know. I was a 5-time DWI and kind of guy, and I wrecked every car I ever owned. And a couple of times I've hit and run, pretty severe hit and runs. You know what I mean? At high speeds kind of stuff. And so, you know, there are people who I owe amends to that I can never, you know, express whatever damage I may have done to them, how sorry I am for that action, you know. And those sorts of things, they tell us that, you know, indirect amends are the only things we can do, staying clean and, you know, carrying the message and doing service to the community at large are the sorts of things that, you know, we can do. And certainly staying clean is probably the number one thing in carrying that message to the addicts who might otherwise be doing the same things that I had done. I know how capable I am of doing damage, you know. And, you know, for me it's easy to, when somebody comes to me and asks for forgiveness, if I'm not super emotionally attached like I was with my father, you know, people whose behavior has been poor and have come to me, I actually feel for them because I just know how much I would hate to have to do what they were trying to do, you know, coming to me and expressing, you know, asking for forgiveness and expressing that they know their actions were wrong. You know, I feel for them. So I know I have that compassion in me. It's much easier for me to have somebody come to me because I actually feel for them. But when it comes to me having to do it, boy, do I hate it. I mean, that's, to me, that's the, I practice my life the way I practice my life because I don't want to have to make amends to anybody. You know, I don't want any new amends. I don't want to have to tell you I'm sorry and that I behave badly. You know, I've had a few opportunities to make some direct amends to some people. I was able to do that, you know, just state what it is that I'd done, you know, that I felt like, was poor, you know, that was bad behavior that I owed amends for. You know, it was a girlfriend that showed up at a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, and when I was 18, she was 12, and she was my girlfriend, and I absolutely led her down, you know, a bad path, you know, hard drugs and harder people, and I don't think that she necessarily felt that way, but I felt it had to be said because, you know, I know that I was supposed to be the one that, like, knew something better, you know what I mean? And, you know, and it's easy for me to do things if I'm not real emotionally dug in, you know, but what happens with old things, old relationships, is that I'm back where I was. I'm back where I was when it happened 35, 40 years ago, you know? And, you know, I haven't had that many direct amends that I've made in my life. You know, it's three or four, you know, not all that many. And much of that is because I try not to make new ones. And I really do practice a lot of indirect amends, especially with the rest of my family, you know, and being a good brother, a good son, a good, you know, uncle, et cetera, you know, I mean, whatever it is. You know, I don't think that they look at me and think, you know, this guy's a maniac, you know. You know, I mean, some of these people know better. You know, my brothers certainly know what I'm about and what I'm, you know, but they also know what I'm about today, you know, because at least a couple are on that same path and the other ones don't have this problem with addiction that I have. You know, I'm not sure what else I can say about forgiveness. I told the fellow Steve that asked me to speak that I'd be willing to speak, but I really felt a little thin on the topic, you know. I know for myself that, you know, I do pray about my behavior, and I do try to look at myself and practice a 10-step, and I'm sure there's some people that probably feel like I haven't practiced enough of the 10-step, especially when it comes to a few service meetings, you know. Yes, Alvin's pointing to my wife. But anyway, I'm not sure that I really have much more to say, and so I'm just going to wrap it up and say that I'm really, really grateful to be here at this convention, and I hope that you all got something out of it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. And now for our second speaker, I'd like to introduce Carrie R. from San Fernando Valley.
Hi, my name's Carrie. I'm an addict.
Hi, Carrie.
Okay.
Before I forget, I want to thank the committee for asking me to speak, even though I'm not fond of it. And I want to thank all the people that have come to support me and that have shown their love and that make funny faces like my son is at me right now. And to try to keep it light, I appreciate that. Anyway, and just the support and the love and all the wonderful suggestions that I got, you know, because I'm pretty much terrified of speaking, especially when there's God knows how many people in here. I just have to confess that I came in here earlier with my husband because I'm a control freak and I had to know where it was. And, you know, I got here last night and they said, I checked the booklet and it says, you gotta show up at, as soon as you get here, you gotta go check in. And I'm like, oh, God, get up there and they're closed. And it's like, what do you mean you're closed? And then Steve comes out, the guy who, I happen to know Steve, but he's like, don't worry about it. Come back tomorrow. And I'm like, well, what do you mean? It says, you know, you're supposed to be here. And so today I wound up going down there. And then after we went there, it's like, okay, we got to go over to the room and I got to check it out. And so we came in here and I thought, okay, and this light wasn't on. So it was kind of warm and dim. And so I thought, okay, and my husband comes in with me. And I walk up here and I go, this is going to be okay. And nobody's going to be here because they're all going to be sleeping. You know, it's midnight. I know I'm usually sleeping for 3 hours by now. So I could sound a little delirious, too. So this is my confession. I come up here and I walk up on the stairs and I go, hi, my name is Carrie. I'm an addict. And my husband says, that's how you should do it the whole way through. I'm very nervous that I'm going to have to talk like this. Anyway, yeah, thank you, everyone for coming and supporting me. Oh my God, he's dimming the light. That's awesome. Thank you. No, well, I guess I do get special treatment because I'm like incredibly nervous. So, anyway, and Paul, thank you for sharing. That was awesome. I heard a lot of how I feel. You know, I got here out of desperation as well. And you know, I did, I'm sure, all the things that many of us have done here. And looking back, you know, it was a horrible thing. I've been married to my husband for almost 29 years. And we have two boys. Yeah, yeah. And I have 13 years clean, so that means that we've had some crazy times together. And I have two boys, and one's an addict who's here. Love you, Dustin. And he's coming up on, he's 2-plus years clean now, and it's fucking amazing. Excuse me, I really shouldn't swear. But, and then my other son is not an addict, and he had to put up with us crazies, okay? So, God bless him, okay? He did the best that he could to stay at his friend's house while we were, in our crazy days. And, I have a lot of, guilt from the things that I did when, you know, I left, basically abandoned my family. Yeah, I was there on the phone, and in my delusional using mind, I thought that I justified, you know, everything that I was doing for however I did it, but it was not a good thing. And I look back, you know, there was one time I was put in jail and my kids were stranded at my dad's house. And, you know, how do you do that with a good conscience? You know, it was horrible. And left them, they were in the snow. I think they were like 9 and 10 years old, and they had to get themselves to the bus and to school the next day all by themselves. No one else was there. My dad, I failed to mention that he wasn't there. And this crazy shit went on for a while until I arrived here. And thank God for this program. You know, and this was the end of the road for me. I had tried, You know, we tried everything. I say we because we did this together. Oh, here we go. I have 1 month more than my husband. He'll be 13 tomorrow. I haven't said it at all. I took cakes. You know, we take cakes in the area that I'm from, and I never said it once. And every year I always say I'm older than my husband because I have a month more than he does. Anyway, so I lost my train of thought. There you go. Anyway, it was just crazy, and I'm just grateful to be here, and I'm grateful that this place was here because as I came back to me, we did everything. You know, I did kicking on my sister's couch a number of times, and went to my dad's house a number of times, and went through rehab once, and then the second time I got it because I was desperate. But it got old, and you know, my family, I wasn't raised in an abusive family, but you know, there's some things that I'm learning, you know, that were not so perfect with my family, and I don't think that it was perfect, I never did, but you know, I've got these character defects that... where, you know, I'm a perfectionist, I'm a control freak, I'm very judgmental, and I'm learning that I am, it's because it's a reflection of me. You know, when I'm judging other people, it's usually something that I don't like in myself. And I used to think that was bullshit, you know, it's like, if you spot it, you got it. But it really is true. And so it's interesting, you know, I have 13 years clean, and it's a process. And I like that, you know, because I this way I know that there's always room for growth. And I'm grateful for that. I'm really grateful for that. So anyway, forgiveness is the topic, and I need to, you need to forgive me because I'm nervous. Actually, you don't. But so I really don't have issues with forgiving other people. My issue is like, I don't really know how to describe this. I don't even know where I was going with that. I do know, but it's just not coming to me. So, asking for forgiveness. I don't know where I was going. I just totally lost it. Anyway, so let me just go back to projecting what I do with other people, my husband, you know, I expect that he should act in a certain way, and you know, and it's ridiculous. And I do this not just with him; I do it with other people. So that's where I need to allow people to be who they are, and by doing that, then I will be at peace. And So I guess that what I'm trying to say is, like, I need to forgive people for being human beings, because I have, like I said, I have like these high expectations of myself, and, you know, God forbid I should forgive myself for not being perfect and allowing myself to just, and that's another thing too, that this whole forgiveness thing is a process. You know, it's an ongoing process that I am not perfect at, and I'm not perfect at anything, so I don't even know why I do that. I'm sure that that's something I'll learn, you know, over time, where it's coming from. I think that that's probably a childhood thing as well. But I'm trying to say this so that I don't front you off too much. My husband works very hard, and this is just an example of an area that where I need to forgive, and it's where I get stuck because I don't want to forgive. So my husband works hard. Here we go again. Okay, and his boss did something that was really screwy to him. That's what I was going to say, is I have a problem with people who do, I don't have a problem with people who do things to me and then ask forgiveness. It's people who, or when people I love are wrong, someone does wrong to them. And that's where I have a problem letting go. So, his boss, you know, does this, you know, rotten thing to him that, he was okay. I mean, he wasn't okay with, but it's his deal. I love him and should respect him in a way to trust that what he's doing is okay. I don't need to get in there and try to control it. And so ultimately it all worked out okay, but I still haven't forgiven that man, and therefore I put shit on him. Because I haven't forgiven him. Now, I don't know if I'm like talking in circles or if this is even making sense at all. You're so sweet. I like you, Jim. I'm going to like keep my focus right there. But like I make these comments, you know, I can't keep this shut. You know, he's whatever. I don't need to get into details, but when he has really good stuff going on, I say, well, is he going to compensate you for that? And really, it's like, it's ridiculous, but at the same time, I mean, these are areas that are, I need to forgive. And besides that, it's not my deal. You know, it's not my deal. And so, maybe if I was a little softer on myself, I wouldn't be so hard on other people. I don't know. Anyway, I don't even know where to go. I'm finding like I have a blank after a blank. So let me think here if something else will come out. I'm really tired. Like I said, I usually go to bed at 9 o'clock. I have been up. I'm so grateful that I'm like here doing this, because now from the time that I finish on, I don't have to stress on this anymore, because I found out about this about 30 days ago and I have not stopped thinking about this and obsessing on it. And, you know, writing notes about it, you know, just like what I think on it. And I guarantee you, well, and then I had opinions on, you should have a flashcard up here with, and I thought, you know what, I could do that. That would be okay. And then as I'm writing things, and I thought, you know, if I have something that's a card in front of me, I won't be able to see it anyway, because I get so nervous I can't even see writing in front of my eyeballs. So I'm grateful that like once I'm done with this, it'll be done. But, you know, I feel like, you know, that I'm missing the message here. There was really actually some good stuff that I was thinking about. And like I said, I don't know. I'm trying to just like stay calm. Yeah, I know. That's what I've done a number of times as well. And, you know, I don't know if it's just because I'm too tired or what. I really am drawing a blank. I'm going to give it a couple more seconds here. I don't even know where to go. What's that? I'll take any advice I could get. I've heard that one before, and that's not working. Yeah, I know. Okay. Here we go. Thank you. You know, what the heck? I guess I could stand here and look like a you know, lame. But that made me think of something. Okay, so I grew up with a pretty loving family, although my parents separated when I was young. They actually were pretty good in that area, except for the fact that I'm finding out that there were some things that I was missing and that had happened to me when I was younger. So, you know, my dad was a big part in me going through many times of stopping and then starting again. And he watched me through my insanity, because when I left my family, I went and stayed with my dad up in his territory in Northern California. And I was crazy. I was like really nuts. And I'll never forget one time, I don't remember what it was that broke the camel's back, but with him, but his tolerance level had just gone. And my father, when I was growing up, was just one of the most mellow individuals ever. He never raised a hand to us. He never yelled or you know, was verbally abusive. All he had to do was just say something in a certain tone, and we knew that just to listen. And he said this thing to me that was very hurtful, and it was, "Why don't you just take a gun to your head and shoot yourself?" when I was in the middle of all my insanity. And I'm telling you, like, I forgive him, even though he never, because I get it. I was crazy, and I don't even know if he remembers he said it. But because he was such a, you know, kind, loving soul, it was really bizarre coming out of his mouth, and it made me really think twice. But I didn't change anything then. It took what it took. And so now, okay, 13 years later, I moved back to Southern California. Thank God my husband and I got back together, and we were able to pull the family, you know, back together and form some, you know, type of normal type of family atmosphere for the kids. And it was too late for Dustin. He was already off running and using. And my dad today, he was involved in an accident, and he was with this woman she's an addict. And he was in an accident and almost died. He had like a couple breaths left, 55 staples in the back of his head. He was on one of those tables, and he was literally almost dead. And he had been drinking. He was diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome, and that was his way to try to take care of himself. So now he has been using ever since, pills. Not that it matters, but that's what he's on. And he is no longer my dad, the dad that I grew up with. So it's very difficult for me, because I don't, it's bizarre, because I just don't even know how to handle it, other than the only way that I can, I guess this is forgiving. I don't even know, but all I could do is love him. I mean, that's the only way I know how, because he's clueless. He's so in denial, it is beyond. And so that's what I do. That's all I do. That's my living amends to him, is to just call and just say, "I love you, Dad," even though he's half out of it. And it's bizarre, because really he's had not nine lives, but about 22 lives, where he's almost died, been in and out of the hospital, airlifted out of his home. And it's just the craziest thing. It's so insane. And you know what it tells me? This disease is crazy. And to watch him go through that and not be able to do anything. And honestly, I hate to say this, because I know people like to think there's always hope. There's no hope in this situation. He's gonna die an addict. I'm absolutely sure of it. And in the state that he's in. So, yeah, it's a horrible, horrible disease. And I'm so glad, I'm so grateful that I have this program, and you know, that I had that desperate need to have some sort of freedom from the life that I was living. And you know, when I got here, I did everything. I was so desperate that I absolutely did everything that was suggested. Got a sponsor, did about 180 meetings in 180 days, and I continue to do the things that are suggested. I do the same things. I may not go to as many meetings, but I still work with my sponsor. I go to meetings and service. That's another thing, you know, that's very important. I have to say that service is what kept me clean. My first year, I, you know, washed cups at my first meeting and did whatever anyone told me I did. So, you know, I don't know that I've talked so much about forgiveness, but there is another thing that I think of, and that is when I hear newcomers share about relapsing, and recently I've heard someone talking about how shameful they felt because of coming back, and that is something that I always think, you know, you got to forgive yourself, because I know that and I'm pretty darn sure that a lot of you are much more forgiving than the people who continue to relapse. And as far as I'm concerned, just keep coming back. You know, that's what matters, because I've seen people relapse over and over again and manage to get this program. So my son being one of them, he struggled for a while, but he just kept coming back. And it's a wonderful thing, and I'm so blessed. And I never thought that I would be a person who says that they're happy that they're an addict, but I so am. And I've said this time and time again that I am, you know, and I know it's not about the drugs, but I am so glad that I ultimately wound up doing heroin, because if it weren't for that, I'd still probably trying to be managing, you know, my drug use. And I don't ever have to wake up wondering, you know, if the connection's going to come, and how I'm going to get it, when I'm going to get it, and where I'm going to get it. And I have such a sense of freedom, and my life is so amazing, and I have done things. I didn't even have dreams close to the things that I've done since I've been here. So I don't know how much I've talked about forgiveness, but I really love this program, and I don't know if it's because I'm just tired or because I'm nervous or the combination, but I don't know if anybody heard anything. Hopefully you did, but I can tell you one thing. I am I'm almost done, and it's a good feeling to be done, and I'm glad that I walked through this, even though it was incredibly difficult. And I just love NA. And thanks for letting me share.
Okay, I want to call up Jose from New York to read We Do Recover.
Hi, family. I'm Jose, and I'm an addict. Okay, here we go. We do recover. When at the end of the road, we find that we can no longer function as a human being, either with or without drugs, we all face the same dilemma. What is there left to do? There seems to be this alternative. Either go on as best we can to the bitter ends, jails, institutions, or death, or find a new way to live. In years gone by, very few addicts ever had this last choice. Those who are addicted today are more fortunate. I want to say that again. those who are addicted today are more fortunate. For the first time in man's entire history, a simple way has been proving itself in the lives of many addicts. It is available to us all. This is a simple spiritual, not religious program, known as Narcotics Anonymous. And amen to that.
All right, before we close, I want to thank our speakers, Carrie R. and Paul E. Okay, I don't think we're going to circle up, but why don't we grab each other's hand or whatever, and you want to circle up? Circle up! All right, circle up. Everybody connected? Okay, let's have a moment of silence for the addicts still suffering, and let this circle represent what we can do together that we cannot do alone. And that's stay clean and find a new way to live. And can we close it in the third step prayer? Is that all right with everyone?
Fill in my life. That is in my recovery. Show me how to live clean.
So much for my moment of silence.